Hello and welcome to the History Hour podcast from the BBC World Service with me, Max Pearson, the past brought to life by those who were there. This week, a cunning plan to protect Italian artworks from being looted by the Nazis in the Second World War.
We were just told that my mum was very unwell and we couldn't go into her room, but she was perfectly fine. She was actually guarding the artworks.
Also, we remember a hero of Catalan nationalism, the trial of O.J. Simpson, as remembered by a friend who testified against him in court.
I felt like I couldn't really trust anybody, but I knew one thing I knew I wasn't going to do. I wasn't going to lie.
And Madonna, the early years.
There was probably a moment where I realized, I don't think I'm her boyfriend anymore, or I'm certainly not her only boyfriend.
That's all to come. But we begin with Ernesto Che Guevara, one of the few figures from history whose name alone can conjure up one of the truly iconic images of the 20th century. It has hung on the walls of students, been printed on countless T-shirts, and even this month, on the 50th anniversary of his death, has caused controversy in Ireland, where the Postal Service has issued a commemorative stamp bearing that image. Che was a trained doctor from Argentina who preached socialism and fought alongside Fidel Castro to establish communism in Cuba. He went on to try to stir up revolution in Congo and then elsewhere in Latin America. And it was in Bolivia in October 1967 that he died at the hands of his Bolivian army captors. Mike Lanchon has spoken to Felix Rodriguez, a CIA operative who helped to track him down and was one of the last people to speak to Che Guevara before he died.
I got everything here from that day, from Che Guevara's capture. This picture of Che on his passport, this back here, is the from the code book of Che.
At home in Miami, Felix Rodriguez shows off souvenirs from one of the proudest moments in his long career fighting communism.
And that's the last picture of Che taken with me before he died, maybe an hour and a half before he was killed.
The slightly faded photograph shows a scowling Che Guevara, his hands tied in front of him, looking straight into the camera. Beside him, a young and stern-looking Felix Rodriguez, in uniform.
To see a man who was so powerful at one point in time in Cuba, and to see the way he was at that point in time. He looked like a beggar, completely different image of what people perceive of him in the world.
La diferencia entre los hombres no está dada por el color de la piel.
We want to build socialism. We have declared that we are partisans of those who strive for peace.
Ernesto Che Guevara and Felix Rodriguez were on opposite sides of the Cold War in Latin America. Rodriguez's uncle had been a minister in the Batista regime in Cuba, which Guevara and Fidel Castro had toppled in 1959. Rodriguez then fled to Miami to plot the armed overthrow of Castro's revolution. Later, he went on to work for the American Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. Che Guevara became the most well-known face of the Cuban Revolution. In the mid-1960s, Guevara left Cuba to try to spread the revolution elsewhere. He went first to Africa and then to Bolivia.
Che's idea of taking over in Bolivia was that he would be able then to have a launching area to be able to export the communist revolution to five different neighboring countries. And also because it was a very poor country and he felt that the United States was not that much interested in that poor country.
But the Americans were interested in what was happening in Bolivia. It was the height of the Cold War, and Che Guevara's aim was a Cuban-style takeover in America's backyard.
President Barrientos, remembering what had happened to President Batista, was scared. He immediately called in American help, and United States Rangers started to train Bolivian anti-guerrilla forces. A total of 25 American advisors arrived in Bolivia to help out.
An officer from the CIA came to Miami. He interviewed 16 of us, and he selected two of us to go to Bolivia in pursuit of Che Guevara to provide intelligence and capability to the 8th Division headquarters, the area where he was operating.
Che Guevara had arrived in Bolivia in November 1966 and had immediately headed for the remote jungle to form his guerrilla army. He'd brought with him a small but experienced band of Cuban fighters. But though they had some early military successes against the Bolivian army, the guerrillas faced an impossible task. Guevara's chronic asthma slowed them down as they moved through the inhospitable terrain. And no sooner did they venture into villages in search of provisions or medical supplies than they were betrayed by informers. On October 7, 1967, the Bolivian army ambushed the guerrillas in a ravine. Guevara was wounded and captured alive.
I was at the time in Valle Grande installing some radio equipment to the Bolivian Air Force. That's when we learned that Che Guevara had been captured.
You must have been very emotional with the prospect of coming face to face with him.
Yes, actually, when I learned of that, it was a big surprise. And I was anxious to meet this individual. So on the following day, I departed in a helicopter with Colonel Centeno. And we landed right next to the schoolhouse where Che was being held. We all came into the room. He was tied down on the left side of the floor. And at that point, I asked for the colonel if I could get all the documentation to be able to photograph it for my government. And I got a pouch that was like a camel collar, and inside was his chest diary. He has some medical things for his asthma. He have like a codebook, numerical codebook that were provided to him by Red China.
The capture of Che Guevara was a huge coup for the Americans, and for Felix Rodriguez, a chance to confront his arch enemy.
Later on, I came back along to the room. I stood in front of him and said, Che, I come to talk to you. And he looked to me very arrogant from the floor and said, nobody talks to me, nobody interrogates me. So at that point in time, I looked at him and said, Commander, I admire you. You used to believe in what you believe in, though I think your ideals are mistaken. I just came here to talk to you, not to interrogate you. So he looked to me for a while and they said, can I sit? Can you untie me? So we untied him and we sat him on a little bench, and that's when we started talking to each other.
Could you tell us what you said to each other? Tell us a little bit about the conversation.
There were times that, for example, he was talking and really I wasn't paying any attention. And my mind was the man that I did remember from the news, because I had never met him before. That arrogant man in a big coat in Red China talking to Mao in the Soviet Union. And now to see this guy that looked like a beggar, that was impacting me tremendously.
Felix Rodriguez says that his instructions were clear. The CIA wanted Che Guevara alive so as to interrogate him properly. The Bolivian military wanted him dead.
And then they say, mi capitán, there is a phone call from the High Bolivian Command. When I answered the phone, there was a simple code that we had developed, and they gave me 500, 600. The simple code was 500 Che, 600 dead, and 700 keep him alive. So I asked them to repeat the message, and he came back 500, 600. So when Colonel Centeno returned from the operational area, I called him aside and said, "Mi coronel, this order from your high command to eliminate the prisoner, 500, 600. My orders for my government is to try to keep him alive at all costs." So look at me and say, "Philip, we are very grateful to you, but this order from my president and my high command." He looked at his watch and said, "You can interrogate him until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. At 2 o'clock, I want you to bring me back the dead body of Che." It was 12:30 in the afternoon. I went to the room. I stood in front of him and said, "Commander, I'm sorry. I tried my best." He turned white like a piece of paper and said, "It's better this way. I should have never been captured alive." And I told him, "If anything you want for your family, if I can pass the message." And then he changed his expression and said, "And tell my wife to remarry and try to be happy." That was his last word. He approached me. We shook hands. We embraced. He stood back and stood in attention, thinking I was going to be the one to shoot him. And I left the room. About 1:10, 1:20, I heard the burst. And that's when Che Guevara was dead.
Che Guevara's body and those of his dead companions were flown by helicopter to Valle Grande and put on display for the world to see.
And there were like 2,000 people waiting in there. There was 4 military planes who carried the generals and admiral from the armed forces of Bolivia. And there was like 10 aircraft from different media. And everybody came close to the helicopter. I just put my cap close to my head. I just moved into the crowd so I was not be able to be photographed by them.
Felix Rodriguez's mission was at an end. Che Guevara was dead. Felix Rodriguez continued his fight against the spread of communism and went on to serve in the US Army in Vietnam. Che Guevara became immortalized in photos, posters, and in music.
People really doesn't know who really Che Guevara was. To me, Che Guevara was an assassin, an adventurer, and he really had no respect whatsoever for human life.
Felix Rodriguez speaking there to Mike Lanchin. And we put a photo of Rodriguez alongside the captured and disheveled Che Guevara in Bolivia on our website. Just look online for BBC Witness. Next, we're going back to the early months of the Second World War and the battle to save Italy's priceless artworks for the nation. Italy, under the fascist dictator Benito Mussolini, had sided with Hitler's Germany. Just as in other European countries, the chaos of war meant that Italian artworks were threatened by bombing and looting. But a plan known as Operation Rescue was launched with the aim of keeping paintings and sculptures safe. Giovanna Rotondi's father was one of the key figures behind the plan, and Giovanna has been speaking to Alice Gioia.
My dad had a great sense of duty, and he put his life at risk to save those artworks, not for a personal gain, but because they were cultural heritage of humanity. What was driving him was his profound love for arts.
Giovanna Rotondi's father, Pasquale, was a young art historian and civil servant working in the small city of Urbino in central Italy when World War II broke out in 1939.
The number of artworks in Italy was really high. It was impossible to save everything, so the Ministry of Culture made a list of the most valuable artworks that had to be saved.
Quelli che chiamavano I capolavorissimi.
They were the so-called capolavorissimi, and their destruction would mean a loss for humanity. The list included paintings by Caravaggio, Titian, Raphael.
Giovanna Rotondi was just a child during World War II. Her father, Pasquale, had started working on Operation Rescue before Italy's fascist government joined the war on the side of the Germans in 1940.
Mussolini, the dictator of Italy, has declared war upon the Allies.
Urbino, the city he lived in, became the centre of the operation because it was a quiet town in central Italy, away from the worst of the fighting.
Before Italy entered the war, my dad started looking for a suitable place to hide the artworks. He found a castle nearby in Sassocorvaro, a tiny village in the countryside away from the main cities that could have become targets for bombing. The castle was situated on the top of a hill, easier to defend if there was a ground attack.
Some of the most important artworks, which could be moved, were taken there, while others were hidden in church basements or other remote spots. Pasquale Rotondi kept detailed lists of where all the artwork was hidden, in case something happened to him.
My dad would drive back and forth across Italy to get the artworks to different refuges. And he didn't rescue just paintings. He tried to gather everything he could, including manuscripts and small statues. As the war went on, the resources from the government gradually decreased and lots of volunteers helped him. There was a point when the only car he was able to find was an old Fiat Balila, an economy car. Once he and his driver had to go through a minefield. And another time they drove through a small river because all the bridges had been bombarded.
What do you remember about that time?
Però mi ricordo un'infanzia estremamente serena.
I have some memories, but I didn't link them to Operation Rescue until much later. For us, it was a normal thing. We never realised how exceptional it was. Dad would leave at dawn and come back very late at night. Both my mum and my dad managed to hide the whole thing from us. He would spend as much time as he could with us. We had a record player, and in the evening we would listen to Beethoven.
E quindi noi sentivamo Beethoven.
In September 1943, Italy surrendered to the Allies, and the whole country turned into a battlefield.
The Italian government has surrendered its armed forces unconditionally. Admiral Cunningham called on the Italian fleet to...
As the Allies headed north, the Germans fought back. And as they began retreating towards Germany, they started looting or destroying everything they found in their path. When the Nazis suddenly became the enemy, Pasquale had to make sure they wouldn't get anywhere near the artworks.
But one night, one of the refuges near Urbino was occupied by the Nazis. When they opened one of the boxes containing the artworks, they found a manuscript by opera composer Gioacchino Rossini, and they thought it was just a pile of rubbish.
When Pasquale Rotondi heard about the Nazi occupation, he rushed to the site and offered to clear the castle of some of that unwanted rubbish so that the German troops could settle in more easily. By doing so, he managed to smuggle out some of the most precious artworks right under their noses.
E per fortuna trovarono I manoscritti di Rossini.
What the SS had found was a lyric opera called The Purge. And my dad, who had a great sense of humour, used to joke that a purge brought us luck. My dad was able to get most of the boxes out of there, but didn't know where to hide them because the whole area was occupied by the Nazis. So he brought them home and hid them for 3 days and three nights under his bed. We were just told that my mum was very unwell and we couldn't go into her room. But she was perfectly fine. She was actually guarding the artworks. Those 3 days and nights must have been a nightmare for my parents. Had the Nazis found out what had happened, they could have killed them. But one night, my mum and dad couldn't resist. They were both art historians, you know. So they opened the boxes and looked at those beautiful paintings by candlelight. There was The Tempest by Giorgione, The St. George by Mantegna. They always remembered it as a magical night.
There was an entire unit within the German military dedicated to art. They sent looted art from occupied countries back to Germany. But as war raged on, they agreed that Italy's religious artworks could be sent to the Vatican on trucks for safekeeping. In Urbino, Pasquale Rotondi was in charge of moving the religious art.
E mio padre infilò nei camion.
But my dad wanted to put in those trucks all the artworks he could, not just the religious ones. So that night, my mum put us to bed, cooked a nice meal for the Nazi commander who was overseeing the operation, and made sure he drank plenty of wine.
The hungover German officer didn't pay much attention to what was going into the trucks.
The day after, the commander realised what had happened. He then took my dad to one side and told him, "I could get both of you killed right now." But eventually he turned a blind eye because, of course, he was the one who got drunk in the first place.
How many artworks did your dad manage to save?
More than 7,000. He tried to save as many artworks as he could. Years later, I was visiting a museum and I was looking at a painting by Bellini and I went, "Wait a minute, I've seen this before." It was one of the paintings that my father had saved, so it must have come through our house at some point.
After the end of the war, Pasquale Rotondi went back to his job with the Ministry of Culture and had a very successful career. He was eventually appointed as a consultant for the restoration of the Sistine Chapel in the Vatican. But the story of Operation Rescue only came out at the end of his life. He died shortly afterwards. His daughter Giovanna also became an art historian, and she now lives in Genoa.
Giovanna Rotondi was speaking to Alicia Gioia and telling the remarkable story of her father's work saving Italian art. Well, the whole question of what happened to valuable artworks across Europe during and after the Second World War has continued to fascinate and frustrate over the decades. To this day, families believe they've been robbed of valuables which ended up enriching those who stole art in the chaos. I'm joined now by Anne Weber, founder and co-chair of the Commission for Looted Art in Europe. What more do we know about the extent of the art that was destroyed or looted in Italy?
Well, there were hundreds of works that were taken from Italy by the Germans, primarily after September 43, after Mussolini fell. And throughout 43, the end of 43 and the rest of 44 and into 45, hundreds of works which were later published in a book by the Italians. And they're still missing. Quite a lot of them are still missing.
This was systematic, wasn't it? Just as the Italians had their Operation Rescue trying to prevent artworks leaving the country, the Nazis were fairly systematic about the way in which they went about. They had special units trying to find this art.
They did have special units all over Europe looking, who were seizing art. In fact, what happened in Italy is there were a number of different units that were taking art, some of which weren't specially designated for that purpose, but part of the army or part of different units that found themselves in places where there were art treasures, and they just seized them. So it was a bit random and haphazard, because by then, of course, the Allies were advancing up into Italy, and so they were taking what the army and different units were taking whatever they could find.
So there was an element of, casual self-enrichment on the part of German troops. They would just pocket something that they found in a church or something?
No, it was more organised than that. I mean, they would take them as units and then take them back to Germany, you know, whether it was to Hitler or whether it was to Goering or whether it was to a special... There were special offices in Berlin.
And they wanted them for what? As aggrandisement of the Nazi ideal?
Well, Hitler had plans for a museum in Linz in Austria, which he was still looking at the plans for this and for the model of this in his bunker in Berlin just before he committed suicide. And in the Linz Museum were going to be all the great artworks of Europe. And indeed, he'd stolen a vast proportion of the artworks in Europe by then.
And where are we now? How much of what was stolen has been returned to rightful owners?
Well, it's very difficult to know how much has been returned, because I know that with the work that we do and other people doing similar work, that we're looking for thousands of works of art on behalf of families from whom they were taken. And despite extensive research, only some 5 to 8% have been found. And that's true of everybody working in this field. So there's an awful lot that's still missing. And of course, the looting that took place, it was very organised, as I say, from individuals as well as from institutions and museums. The museums and institutions tended to get a lot of their stuff back unless it was taken to Berlin and then seized in Berlin by the Soviets, who took a lot back to the Soviet Union, and that's never been returned. And there are millions of books, and there's a vast amount of paintings that are in Russian museums today that was taken. But for the individuals, some of it ended up, it was traded on the art market. It's art that Hitler didn't want, or that Goering didn't want, or the senior Nazis didn't want, was traded on the art market. So it's been circulating on the art market ever since, which also makes it very difficult for people to find.
And so the hunt goes on. Are you sort of like knocking on doors in grand houses and so forth all the time?
All the time. We found a work that is going up for auction actually this week in Austria, which belonged to a family, now British, who were originally, their forebears were Austrians, Jews, and it was taken from them in 1941, seized in 41. Things turn up all the time. We're a painting in Germany, which we believe is going to be returned next week. Another painting in a German museum that's going to be returned. A painting that we found in a German cathedral collection, which was looted and is there now. So we're very persistent. Perhaps I should add that there were, at the end of the war, the Allied forces collected up what they could find. And quite a lot of works were then returned to the countries from which they'd been taken. And there was a period of restitution which took place at the, you know, in the late 40s, early 50s. But that was only a fraction of what had been taken. And that's why there is still so much that is missing.
Anne Weber of the Commission for Looted Art in Europe, many thanks. And that story of Operation Rescue in Italy, aimed at saving Italian art, will be going into our World War II collection on the website. If you search for BBC Witness Collections online, you can find a whole host of witnesses to events from the past grouped by subject matter to make it easier for you to find the material which most interests you. That's BBC Witness Collections. And just a reminder that this week's witness film on the website tells the story of Britain's worst ever nuclear accident. And please don't forget, you can interact with us by sending your thoughts on items or people we should look at to illustrate key events from the past. Just email witness@bbc.co.uk, and you can follow us on Facebook, search for BBC Witness. Still to come in this podcast, Madonna, the early years, as remembered by her boyfriend, and a hero of Catalan nationalism executed by Spain's fascists.
At 9 o'clock, we went to retrieve my brother's body. He looked the same as yesterday. He still had the same smile on his lips.
But before that, an event which became known in the popular press as the trial of the century. It involved the black American football legend and film star O.J. Simpson. He'd been charged with the murder of his ex-wife and her friend. In October 1995, amid a global media circus in Los Angeles, Simpson was found not guilty. The verdict was sensational, and it fueled tension and debate in a city already troubled by accusations that the police force was institutionally racist. Rebecca Kesby has been speaking to Ron Shipp, a close friend of O.J. Simpson's. He was also a police officer and was persuaded to testify for the prosecution. And a word of warning, there are some graphic descriptions in this item.
When I knew I was going to testify, it was the worst thing in my life that I'd ever been faced with. I mean, I absolutely, positively love the guy.
Ron Shipp was from a family of police officers. He first met O.J. Simpson as a schoolboy in 1968, when O.J. was already a star on the football field. And by the 1980s, Ron and his wife were regular visitors to the Simpson household that O.J. then shared with his second wife, an attractive model, Nicole Brown.
As a couple, they were hilarious. And O.J. was the type of person, he made you feel good.
You got on really well with Nicole, didn't you? What sort of woman was she?
She was fantastic. She was a very funny woman. I mean, I used to watch them together, and they were always joking and, you know, goofing off. Like I said, as far as I was concerned, they were the ideal couple.
But by 1989, their relationship was in trouble. On New Year's Day, police responded to reports of domestic violence at the Simpson household. Reports showed that Nicole told the police she feared for her life. She'd been beaten so badly she was hospitalised. She also said she'd called the police 8 times before. O.J. Simpson pleaded no contest to a charge of spousal abuse and was sentenced to 120 hours community service. But Ron was concerned, particularly because he taught a class on domestic abuse to police officers.
He was the first one to tell me that they had some kind of a fight, scuffle, whatever you want to call it. But it was later on when I ended up talking to her, when she was telling me about how he had been beating her, you know, hitting her for years. She showed me the pictures of past beating. My heart sunk. I couldn't believe it. And I explained to her the things about domestic violence, jealousy, aggressive, you know, anger, just the different profiles. And she just kept telling me, well, you know, OJ's every one of those. I went, whoa, really?
Ron says Nicole asked him to speak to her husband, OJ, about domestic violence.
And I did the very next day. And he denied all of them. He said the only thing that he felt, he says, I might be a little bit jealous. He said, but that's it.
The couple divorced in 1992 and were living separately when, early in the morning on June the 13th, 1994, Nicole Brown Simpson was found brutally murdered on the steps of her home. The body of a restaurant waiter, Ron Goldman, was found close by. Ron Shipp remembers hearing the news.
I guess I didn't really want to believe it.
While the investigation was underway, did you see OJ?
Oh, I did see OJ. The day after the murders, I called the house and I said, should I come over? He goes, yeah, man, come on over here. When I was driving over there, the first thing that went through my mind was, I hope he doesn't have any cuts.
Why?
Because from being a cop on numerous assault calls, especially stabbings, it's like 8 out of 10 guys seem like they always seem to cut themselves. You know, blood squirting everywhere. It's all in their hands and the knife slips out of their hands. And, when I got to OJ's house and I walked through the door, he was sitting on the couch and the first thing I saw, his left finger was bandaged. I just couldn't help it. I said, OJ, what happened to your finger? And he just said, I cut it on a glass in Chicago. But what happened then was even worse, you know, because then somebody else came over, asked OJ, what happened to your finger? OJ said, oh, I was chipping golf balls out on the front lawn. And then maybe a couple hours later, somebody else asked the same question. And he said, oh, I was trying to get the cell phone out of the car. I looked at him again and went, man, you just told 3 different stories, you know, from 3 different questions. You have a fresh cut on your finger after your ex-wife's been stabbed and murdered. They asked him to take a lie detector test. I said, well, did you say yes? And then he told me at the time, no, I didn't. And I said, why would you say no, OJ? And he said, well, you know, he kind of laughed and said, to be honest, Ship, I've had dreams of killing her. And a lot of times when people get ready to take a lie detector test and they're guilty, I'm not saying all the times, but they will tell you an excuse as to why they don't pass it. So when he said that he had dreams of killing her, I wanted to get the heck out of there. And as I left, I called my wife, told her that I believed OJ had killed Nicole, and I cried all the way home.
Although Ron suspected that OJ Simpson may be responsible for the double murder, when the case came to trial, he didn't really want to testify against his friend.
I was just so torn, I got to be honest, I didn't know what was up and what was down anymore. I really didn't.
Ron was persuaded to testify when he found himself alone in the office of the district attorney. In front of him was a book of photographs and detailed shots of the murder scene.
I opened the first page and there was a bunch of nice pictures of Nicole in there. Turned another page and bam, there was the homicide scene pictures. And I just almost just passed out. It's one thing to see, you know, I've been on a lot of homicides throughout my career at LAPD. You know, of course you feel bad for the families, but you don't know them. But for me to look at these pictures of Nicole, who not, you know, I knew very well, you know, I've hugged her and, you know, laughed with her, and to look and see that here's her head almost severed. Even today, I can't even describe what that was like. Poor Ron, you know, he had all these stab wounds in his hands, you know, trying to fight him off. Absolutely horrific. I said, I'll do it. I said, I will testify.
O.J. Simpson has always denied the murders. He assembled an experienced and expensive group of lawyers to defend him against the charges. They became known as the Dream Team, and one of their key arguments was that the Los Angeles Police Department was institutionally racist, and they claimed that incriminating evidence was planted to frame O.J. Simpson.
But this statement about whether somebody sounds black or white is racist, and I resent it, and that's why I didn't object to it.
Everyone in this case is that no one planted any evidence at any time.
You are both a cop and an African-American man, and so you're in this situation, in this courtroom. What was it like to walk into that?
It was really weird because once I walked through that door, my legs started shaking. People were dropping like flies as far as my friends. I felt like I couldn't really trust anybody. But I knew one thing I knew I wasn't going to do. I wasn't going to lie.
You do realize, Mr. Ship, that by testifying as you have, you are going to enhance the name of Ron Ship.
But that's not why I'm doing this, Mr. Douglas. I'm doing this for my conscience and my peace of mind. I will not have the blood of Nicole on Ron Ship. I can sleep at night, unlike a lot of others.
On October the 3rd, 1995, after just 2 hours of deliberation, the jury reached its verdict.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant Orenthal James Simpson not guilty of the crime of murder.
Ron Shipp watched the verdict in the prosecutor's office.
When they said not guilty, I just couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. And then I just started thinking about, okay, what is our life going to be like now? Because I was the only person that testified against him. I was called, you know, you sell out. You know, I was called so many names. It broke my heart.
In 2008, O.J. Simpson was convicted of a different crime, armed robbery and kidnapping. He was released from jail earlier this month. Ron Shipp retired from the LAPD and is about to publish a new book called The Witness.
Rebecca Kesby. Now, you've probably noticed that the Catalan region of Spain has been riding high in the global news headlines this month. A referendum, which was not sanctioned by the government in Madrid, resulted in a yes vote for independence. Catalan regional leaders have now signed a declaration of independence, but the move will not be implemented to allow time for more talks with the central government. The question of Catalan nationalism has simmered, though, for decades. Using accounts from the time, Simon Watts now brings us the story of Luis Companys, who has inspired generations of nationalists. In 1940, he was executed by a Spanish fascist firing squad.
It's the autumn of 1940,
In exile in France, Carme Ballester, the wife of Lluís Companys, is waiting for news about the Catalan leader. Her words are read here by an actress.
Jo cada dia esperava noves e així escoltava la ràdio.
I was listening to the radio. I heard on the morning news that my husband had been shot dead.
Havia estat afusellat.
Some of the neighbours came rushing round because they'd also heard the news. They found me passed out on the floor.
Lluís Companys had been executed at dawn the previous morning at Montjuïc Castle overlooking Barcelona. The fascist authorities tried to keep his death a secret, but news soon spread around the Catalan capital. This is how it was reported in a clandestine leaflet.
Lluís Companys was shot in a ditch near Montjuïc at 6:30 in the morning. He was expecting such an end and awaited his fate with solemnity, bravery and determination. Shortly before he was executed, he asked to take off his shoes so he could die with his feet on Catalan soil. He cried out, "Long live Catalonia!"
Born in 1882, Lluís Companys lived through a turbulent time in Spanish and Catalan history. Initially a left-wing lawyer, Companys had two core beliefs. He thought Spain would only prosper if it became a modern country with a modern republican government, and he believed Catalonia should become its own self-governing state within a Spanish federation. Companys was elected regional president, and in 1934 he led a short-lived uprising against the right-wing government in Madrid. His independent Catalonia was crushed within 10 hours, and he was sentenced to decades in prison.
I guanyarem! Guanyarem! Perquè tenim un exèrcit modèlic amb organització!
2 years later, civil war broke out in Spain. The Republicans, who controlled Barcelona, freed Companys and restored him to office. As Catalan regional president, he led the fight against General Franco's fascist forces, but also presided over a period of chaos in which anarchists and Republican extremists are thought to have killed several thousand people. Companys himself signed dozens of death sentences.
Un Estado totalitario harmonizará en España.
When General Franco and the fascists won the civil war, Lluís Companys fled across the border to France. After the German invasion at the beginning of World War II, there was always the danger that Nazi forces would hand Companys over to their allies in Spain. In August 1940, the Gestapo came for him.
Dos homes vestits en civil i quatre amb uniforme de soldats alemanys.
2 men in civilian dress and 4 in German uniform came into the house with machine guns. They turned the house upside down. They also took all the documents they could find. Through all this, the soldiers were pointing their weapons at my husband as he sat in a chair. I had to take the civilians round with a revolver stuck in my back. When the operation was complete, the 4 soldiers took the president of Catalonia away into custody.
Carme Ballester found out that her husband was being held at the Nazi headquarters in a local chateau.
You can imagine how I felt at the time, alone, with only 10 centimes in my pocket. But I tried to be brave, and the next day I got my bike out and went to Chateau Caroline. I said I had a meeting with an officer, and I managed to look so confident that they waved me through. I saw a group of 4 soldiers with my husband in the middle. They were transferring him. I just cried out, "Lluís!" He turned and gave me a "get out of here" signal with his hand. I never saw him again.
The Nazis handed Companys over to Franco. He was held in solitary confinement and tortured. And a few weeks later, he appeared before a military tribunal at Montjuïc Castle. The Kangaroo Court sentenced the elected Catalan leader to death for crimes including resisting Franco's glorious crusade. This is what his sister, Ramona Companys, wrote in her diary.
Tota la tarda vaig estar esperant un passe per anar a Montjuïc.
I spent the whole afternoon waiting for a pass to go to Montjuïc Castle. Finally, at 8 p.m., his defense counsel told me the news was bad. I don't remember ever feeling such strong emotion.
No recordo haver sentit mai tan forta emoció.
By 10 p.m., I was at the castle. We were told we could only see my brother through a window, and he seemed to be writing. I was beside myself, because I wasn't being allowed to give my brother a last embrace. The commanding officer said he couldn't give permission, but I could go and ask a judge.
Ramona Compan's tearful testimony persuaded the judge to allow her and her sisters to enter their brother's cell for a final visit.
He asked us if we came in a taxi, and when he realized that the driver might have missed dinner, he remembered that he still had a lot of food left from the morning. He ended up preparing a little parcel for him. Then he said, he'll probably want some cigarettes too.
Jo, Lluís Companys Jové, trobant-me al castell de Montjuïc.
I, Lluís Companys, finding myself at Montjuïc Castle, facing a court-martial, certify that I have written this document.
This is the will of Lluís Companys, written the night before his execution.
A tots els que m'han agraviat, perdono.
I forgive all who have offended me, and I ask forgiveness from all whom I have offended. If I am to die, I will die calmly. There is not a single drop of bitterness within me. I will give thanks to God for allowing me the beauty of dying for my beliefs. My humble being could not hope for a more worthy end, to die for Catalonia and how it embodies peace, justice and love.
Per Catalunya i lo que representa de pau, justícia i amor.
Before dawn, two priests came to Lluís Companys' cell to say Mass. As a former altar boy, he even offered to help them with the service. Then, for his final request, Companys asked for bread with Catalan chocolate and a bottle of cognac. On the way to his death, Companys smoked cigarettes and chatted to the priests. Asked if he wanted a blindfold, he refused. Witnesses later said that the firing squad were visibly nervous and that Companys looked them in the eyes throughout his execution.
A les 9 hem anat a rebre el cadàver del meu germà al cementiri nou. Estava com ahir.
At 9 o'clock, we went to retrieve my brother's body. He looked the same as yesterday. He still had the same smile on his lips that I had seen a few hours before. I kissed and caressed my dead brother, and then I told them they had shot the best man in the world. As I am a Christian, I raised my eyes to heaven and had the strength to say, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do.
Since the return of democracy to Spain, Lluís Companys has become an iconic figure for Catalan nationalists. The Olympic Stadium in Barcelona, on Montjuïc Hill, is named after him, as are many streets across the region. And as Catalans continue their troubled relationship with Madrid, Lluís Companys' legacy is being discussed and debated more than ever before.
Simon Watts with that timely reminder of the story of Lluís Companys, regarded by many as a martyr to the cause of Catalan nationalism. Finally this week, a look at the early life of a woman who will go down as being among the most significant in 20th century pop music. It's now 35 years since the first single, Everybody, was released by Madonna. She's gone on to become the biggest-selling female recording artist of all time and has performed in all corners of the globe during numerous sell-out world tours. But as Lucy Burns has been finding out, it wasn't always like that. She's been speaking to one of Madonna's early boyfriends.
Stephen Bray met Madonna in the late 70s when she was studying dance at the University of Ann Arbor in Michigan.
I was working at a discotheque called the Blue Frog. She came in one night and pretty much cleared the floor with her look at me act, which she still is doing to this day. And I said, I'm going to buy that woman a drink. And I did, a gin and tonic. She says she bought me a drink, but I bought her a drink.
So you were literally working as a waiter in a cocktail bar.
I was a waiter in a cocktail bar. That much is true.
They started going out, on and off.
And I had a band that played around town, and she would come see the band. And, you know, we'd obviously talk about music that we liked, but she was much more sort of poetry, art, and dance. And I was sort of the, you know, rhythm and blues guy.
Madonna left Michigan and moved to New York. And a few years later, so did Stephen.
I called her and said, what's going on? Can you introduce me to some musicians? And she said, hey, by the way, I've become a musician. I have a band and I've just lost my drummer. And would you come and play drums with me? And of course, you know, it was a dream come true.
And so what band was that?
We went through lots of names. She had, like, I think when I first got there, we were called the Millionaires or something like that. And then I think there was Modern Dance. And then I think we settled on Emmy. Then at one point she said, I think we should just be Madonna. And I said, I don't think so. That's way too Catholic.
Also, that takes a certain amount of chutzpah to be like, hey guys, our new name is my name.
Well, it went with the territory. It wasn't completely surprising. I had never met anyone that wanted to achieve things in the same or greater degree than I did. And for me, one of her most attractive qualities was that ambition.
And was that popular with everybody, or did that get on some people's nerves?
I think it got on most people's nerves. You know, people call it careerism or manipulation or whatnot, but I just saw it as focus.
But in those early days, with their spiky post-punk sound, things weren't going so well for the band.
When we first started, we were literally taking the subway to gigs. We played all over the place and made no money, but it was like the most fun I ever had had, even if we were, you know, you would just hear like three people clapping and they were probably our friends. We probably net like $6 between the three of us.
And beyond the ambition, was there at that point something about her performance which kind of made you go, oh, that's a bit different?
There's something about the energy she exudes that says, I want, and I will have you all looking at me. You know, she used to say to me, I'm not Aretha Franklin. Don't try to make me sing like Aretha Franklin. But she made up what she might not have had in, say, let's say, chops like an Aretha Franklin. She gave you all the passion and she gave you all the commitment. And so in that regard, you know, she was unstoppable.
Stephen and Madonna had started working on some songs with a dancier edge.
There's a song called Ain't No Big Deal and a couple others, and she took them around to Danceteria, which was like the place to dance in New York in those times. And Mark Kamens, who was the DJ, was playing the song, and Warner Brothers sort of got wind of it. And so that kind of ensured this kind of move from the punky Chrissy Hynde to Pretenders sound into this danceable sound, which, you know, obviously caught on.
Another of the songs they were working on was an upbeat track called Everybody.
I can't remember what she brought me, but I think I added bass lines and chords, and so it kind of went from this raw, she probably had the everybody part done, and I think I probably helped flesh it out into verses and bridge and stuff like that. The tech was pretty low back then, and we'd record everything on two cassette machines where you'd have to record like the beat and say the guitar part on one cassette and then sing while that cassette was playing onto a second cassette player. And so probably at the end of the day, it's probably a four-track demo.
With the help of Danceteria DJ Mark Kamens, Madonna was discovered by legendary record producer Seymour Stein, and she was signed to Sire Records for a two-single deal.
And what was your personal relationship like at that point?
Well, by then, there was probably a moment where I realized, I don't think I'm her boyfriend anymore. Or I'm certainly not her only boyfriend.
Like, how serious were you? Were you upset by that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. But I recognize that what she is and was and what we were together in terms of a musical team, those kind of creative relationships are not easily come by.
But what did sting was when Stephen discovered that he wasn't going to get to produce her debut single, but that her new boyfriend, Mark Kamens, was going to do it instead.
Now that was far more painful than breaking up with Madonna. That, to give you a sort of sense of this, of what my agenda was, I wanted to produce. And so finding out that I couldn't produce her first single was far more painful than breaking up.
So did you have a falling out?
Oh yeah, yeah. We probably didn't speak for a year.
Everybody was released on October the 6th, 1982. It reached number 107 in the Billboard singles charts, although it did get to number 3 in the dance club song charts.
Everybody wasn't a massive success.
Well, by my standards, it was. For me, just to see something I was involved with, I mean, even though I was disappointed by the fact that I didn't produce it in name, I was really proud of the fact that, because that's, to me, the magic of turning on the radio and hearing something that you worked on in a room somewhere and, you know, in some apartment on 8th Street. It may not have been a giant success in terms of chart positions and whatnot. It was the brass ring as far as I was concerned.
From Everybody, Madonna went on to release a second single, Burning Up, and then a debut album, Madonna, in July of 1983, which went 5 times platinum. And she got back in touch with Stephen.
she came to me and said, I know that you feel like I, you know, let you down, but I would like you to come write, you know, I'd like to write songs for my next album. They want to do another album with me, and I'd like to write some songs with you. And I thank you, Mom and Dad, for not raising an idiot. I said, sure, that sounds like a good way to, you know, patch things up and move forward, which we did.
Stephen Bray went on to work with Madonna on a number of her biggest hits of the 1980s, including Into the Groove, Express Yourself, and Papa Don't Preach.
Despite what people say to about her, sadly, she did not have to call me for that. There's a lot of songwriters in New York City. I completely give her credit, you know, and would love to sort of dispel some of those folk tales about her being so manipulative and sort of venal when it comes to the decisions she makes, because she did not have to call me, and she did. And so, yeah, we went on to write for 10 years together.
And did she kind of change over those 10 years?
Not really. The ambition is clearly still there. She wanted to rule the world, and she set out to do that. And she has not. I don't see her as changing much. She's very, very single-minded, and has incredible focus and drive and energy. Those same qualities that were so attractive then, you know, she's still got.
Stephen Bray went on to write songs for musicals. He won a Tony for his work on the Broadway version of The Color Purple, and Madonna went on to be a pop icon.
Lucy Burns was remembering Madonna, the early years with Stephen Bray. That's it from this edition of the History Hour podcast. We'll be remembering more significant people and events from the past next week. Please do join us again then. This is Max Pearson. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.